Chuck Cicera first arrived in Alaska in a VW bus in 1955. He and his wife, Anne, built a life that encompassed a career in aviation, government, and business. I'm Lori Townsend. Cicera witnessed the beginnings of statehood and the growth of the Alaskan community. His new book is Chuck Cicera's Alaska, Propellers, Politics, and People. He joins us today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Alaska Pacific University is a private liberal arts and sciences university that emphasizes student engagement with the social, cultural, and environmental issues in Alaska and the world. This message sponsored by APU.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. Sometimes you meet people who have tried so many things, it makes your own adventures pale by comparison. I can definitely say that about my guest today on Talk of Alaska. Chuck Cicera came to Alaska at a time when roughing it was the normal course of things, and he didn't just get by. He and his family thrived. Good morning, Mr. Cicera.
Good morning. Good morning. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. Chuck has a new book out, and it's not quite in stores yet, but I have a copy of it in front of me, and I'm going to hold it up so those in TV land can see the book. For those of you on radio, I'm sorry, but we will put a copy of the photo of it on our website later this morning, so you can go to alaskapublic.org and check out the cover of the book. You, in reading about your early days in the 40s and 50s, you have such amazing detail. I haven't finished the book. I'm still reading it. But you have such amazing detail in your recollections and your writing. How have you managed to keep that so sharp? Did you keep journals and have you been writing throughout your life? Or tell us about that.
No, I just tell stories. And I just string them out and keep them going. So it just I just keep doing it. I've told the same stories over and over probably 1,000 times. I've got them pretty well committed to memory. But no, I didn't write a journal.
Really? Because the recall of the dialogue, too, is particularly good. And it's much more compelling and entertaining to read when you can read the exchange between people. So that's been a lot of fun to read those bits of dialogue throughout the book.
Yeah. Good. I'm glad you're enjoying it.
I am enjoying it. So if you would like to join our conversation today, we're talking to Chuck Cicera. He was a lawmaker. He has flown almost 200 different airplanes. He's sailed many places around the world in 9 different yachts. So this has been a very adventurous life in Alaska. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number to call in statewide is 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. Or in the Anchorage area, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. You came by your love of adventure. Quite honestly, your parents love to travel and try new things. When you were 9 years old, your parents moved you to the Panama Canal Zone. Why did your family go there? Tell us about that.
My dad had been there when he was a kid. He ran away from home when he was 13 years old, ended up in Barranquilla, Colombia, and then he walked across the Andes Mountains and went all the way to Valparaiso in Chile. Then he got up, jumped a ship and went to Panama. And so when he got to Panama, he was only 15 years old, he applied for a job, and they said, you come back when you're older. So so in 1940, he applied for a job in the Panama Canal Zone, and we were living in Florida at the time, and he got accepted this job. So we picked up, sold the house, sold the car, and jumped a flying boat, Pan American flying boat, down to Havana, Cuba. And then from Havana, we went by ship to Panama to our new home in the Canal Zone. Loved it down there. My mother loved it. We loved it. It was great.
And you, they kept that adventurous spirit pretty much throughout their lives, too. How big was their influence on the decisions that you made as far as the things that you tried and the adventures that you went on?
Well, having parents that would be willing to do anything and go anywhere was an easy start on the whole thing. So I just followed their natural path. But I would like to mention a couple of things. One, my mother married my dad 4 days after she met him, and she didn't know his last name. And she found out his last name when they're filling out the application for the marriage certificate. They paid $2 to get married, and that was in 1930, and it lasted 59 years. So much for long engagements. And my mother was just as adventurous as my dad. It would do anything, anywhere, and do anything. You know, she was quite a gal.
Yeah, what a pair. If you're just joining us this morning for Talk of Alaska, my guest is Chuck Cicera. He has a book out, a memoir, and a lot of really amazing and entertaining stories. The book is called Chuck Cicera's Alaska, Propellers, Politics, and People. One of the blurbs on the back of your book is by Alaskan Bert Baumhoff. And he wrote, Chuck Cicera is a typical Alaskan, which means there's nothing typical about him. Why do you think that's so true? That's true of so many people here in Alaska.
Well, I think this land draws people who are adventurous. Some are drug up here by their wrists or their ankles, but for the most part, the reason they stay is because they have an adventurous spirit. So that's what makes this the country that it is.
Mm-hmm. You told me that although your book is definitely filled with a lot of adventures, and I want us to talk about those this morning, you really feel that this book is a love story. Tell us why that is.
Well, I grew up in the Canal Zone, as I said, and I told my parents I wanted to play football. They didn't have football in Panama. So I went by myself to Los Angeles, checked into a high school. I hadn't been in there more than 4 or 5 days, and I ran into this little strawberry blonde, and I said, who are you? And she said, my name is Ann. I said, come on over here. Let's hold hands. So we held hands for almost 60 years. Well, as a matter of fact, it was 62 years. We were married 58 years. Mm-hmm. And she was fantastic gal. She grew up in the Hollywood scene. I mean, she her best friend was Walt Disney's daughter, if you know the kind of crowd she ran with. And she worked for 20th Century Fox Studios, Movie Tone News, when we were first married. And so I drug her out of that scene up to Alaska, and we homesteaded out by Big Lake. So she was out there chasing moose with a 30-06 right off the bat. I mean, she was made the whole transition, and I laughed like heck at the fact that she had been having lunch with Clark Gable, and a year later, she's out in the woods skinning out a moose, you know. And that was Anne, you know. She did it all, and she was right with me, right at my side for 58 years. She died in my arms after 58 years of marriage.
She must have had a tremendously adventurous soul.
She did, and she was an absolutely fantastic gal. And I wrote a really wonderful dedication to her in the book, and I think that spells out our relationship and how I felt about her.
We are talking about adventuring in Alaska and Chuck Cicera's new book. You can join our conversation if you have questions, or maybe you ran into him on some of his flights around the state. You can call us at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. Or in the Anchorage area, 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Tell us about your first job. When you came to Alaska, you got a job that first day with Pacific Northern Airlines. Tell us about how that happened.
Well, we had driven up to Alaska in a Volkswagen bus that I bought in Santa Monica, California. And it was a brand new bus, and it was a 54 bus. I had it when I was finishing up UCLA, and we climbed in that thing and drove it to Alaska. It was the first bus to ever come up here. In fact, it was the first bus to pass through Seattle. We drove it up here, and we drove it and parked up to Eagle River and camped by the bridge, which was down at the bottom of the big ravine in those days. Next morning, I got up and brushed my teeth and put on a clean shirt. We drove into town and went by Merrill Field, and I jumped out of the car, and I said, waved my arms and said, look at all these airplanes. My God, I already knew how to fly. I'd actually owned an airplane by that time. But I couldn't believe the amount of planes that were in the air. So we cruised from there over to Anchorage International Airport, watched the float planes for about 2 minutes, then went over to the new one-story tall building that said Anchorage International Airport with a gravel parking lot out in front. We went in there, and there was the first door I came to was Pacific Northern Airlines, and I knocked on the door, and the girl said, what can I do for you? I said, I'd like to talk to the manager. So she escorted me in, and I met this fellow. He was just a really wonderful guy to work for, by the way. And so I went. I said, I've just arrived in town. I graduated from college about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I'm ready to go to work. I know about airplanes. I already know how to fly. And I said, I think I can do a good job for you. He said, you're hired. So I'd only been in Anchorage for about an hour and 15 minutes, and I was hired. Next morning at 6 o'clock, I was working for Pacific Northern Airlines as a dispatcher / ticket agent.
And you guys had some competition going at that time with another airline. Tell us about that.
Well, it was a kick. You know, we had exact same schedule with our Constellations that Northwest was using. They were using the same timetable, time scheme, whatever you're going to call it. They were taking off at the same time is what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. And they used Douglas DC-7s, which are kind of a homely mud, I think, but not as pretty as a Constellation. And we did everything we could to beat them into the air and beat them to Seattle. It was a race every day. And we'd get emails, not emails in those days, but telexes back saying, who won?
So it was a friendly competition.
Yeah, it was very friendly, yeah.
How long did you work there?
I only worked there about, I think it was a little less than a year, because by that time I had decided I wanted to buy an airplane and go into business for myself. So I launched my aviation career with a little Taylor craft, two placed side by side, 65 horse Taylor craft on floats. And I was out living out of Big Lake, and I started cheating a little bit by hauling hunters and fishermen around. I didn't have a commercial pilot's license, but anyway, that's how I got started in the business. And of course, that led to another airplane and another airplane, another airplane, another airplane, until at the end of it, I had owned over 200 airplanes and had flown 178 different models of airplanes for 28,600 hours.
Wow. Your parents, did they come to Alaska at the same time that you did?
They had been up here the year before. My mother hated it. My dad was okay with it. He was out on the Aleutian chain working and making pretty good money. But they decided to come into back to L.A. because they wanted to be there for our wedding, for Ann and I, for our wedding. And so my mother was really not very impressed with Alaska. She was living in a more or less a shack out in edge of town, you know, and she's used to beautiful flowers and stuff of Panama, you know. Anyway, so I hadn't, we got married, and I went to work for the RAND Corporation and had in the think tank, and I met a guy there that had been to Alaska, and he kept talking about it, and I kept talking to him, and I started getting a different view of Alaska from than I got from my mother. I said, I'm going up there. So I told Ann to quit her job at 20th, and I quit my job at RAND. And I just graduated a week or so before that. And we grabbed my diploma and what clothes we had and threw them in the Volkswagen bus and drove up here. And my mom and dad, not to be outdone, built a camper from scratch. They didn't sell campers. They took this homemade camper and followed us up. And we watched them in a rearview mirror, and their truck was an old International with the headlights were kind of close together, so we nicknamed it Beady Eyes. And my mother kept watching the little Volkswagen bus out ahead of her, which had a pretty high road clearance in those days and narrow tires. And so it was sort of dancing over the rocks because we had 22 or 23, 2400 miles, whatever it was, of rocks and gravel and then mud and then dust. you know, all at the same time. And this poor little thing was bouncing from rock to rock, so she started calling it Twinkle Toes.
So you had beady eyes and twinkle toes.
Beady eyes and twinkle toes, and made it to Anchorage.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and my guest today is Chuck Cicera. He is a former state lawmaker. He's flown almost 200 different planes and has spent a lot of time cruising around Alaska through business and adventuring. His book is Chuck Cicera's Alaska, Propellers, Politics, and People. If you'd like to join us, you can call toll-free 1-800-478-8255 around the state or in the Anchorage area. The number is 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's talk about some of the stories that are in the book now. You once had to put down a plane on Chacachamna Lake, and you ended up spending 6 days on the ice waiting to be rescued. What happened? Tell us about that.
Well, I was an air taxi operator in Bethel at the time. That was 1976. And I had a Cessna 206 that needed a radio installed and need some other work done on it. And it was Super Bowl weekend. I needed a haircut, needed to see a dentist. Hadn't seen my wife and kids in weeks and weeks and weeks. So I decided to come into Anchorage. I checked the weather. The weather looked moderate, you know, okay, you know. And so we took off. Filed a flight plan, took off. I had a guy that jumped in the plane at the last minute, bumming a ride. Turned out he'd decided he didn't like that ride that much. But we actually had a pretty nice ride till we got to Sparavon, and we started up over Merrill Pass, and it was okay. We came down on Merrill Pass on the Anchorage side. Still, the weather was okay. But as we were coming down the length of the lake, the snow started falling hard, and it was snowing so hard that I had to make a 180-degree turn. Now I was faced with going back up, climbing back up, and going through the pass. And having flown that pass hundreds of times and looked at all the wreckage of the various airplanes that had tried to get through in bad weather, I made another 180-degree turn and went back out to take another look at the Anchorage end of the pass. And it wasn't open, so I made another 180-degree turn and went back. And I was still kind of tempted to go up there, but all I could think about was all the wreckage scattered around and the several hundred people that had gotten killed. I know, I think it was something like 50 that got killed right near the apex of the pass. So I thought, no, that isn't going to work. So I came back down, and at that point, it was obvious that I wasn't going to be able to get out of that hole. So I did what I did in every case where I got into that kind of situation. I put the plane down. So I landed in pretty deep snow. It jerked the left main wheel off and the nose wheel off in the deep snow. And we sat there for a week. We were on a flight plan. I knew they'd find us. So we brushed the snow off the plane, which was maroon color. And I figured, well, we'll just sit here and they should show up here in an hour or two. Well, we waited six days for the weather to improve. And they'd been looking hard for us. In fact, one funny thing happened after I was just, they picked me up and brought me in. A guy came by with a beaver looking for us, and of course we jumped up and down with joy and waved our arms, and so they knew we were okay, and then they sent a 185 in on skis to pick us up. And when we got back to Merrill Field, there was a delegation of people waiting for us. Some young girl with the NBC radio and TV in those days stuck a microphone in my face, and she says, "How'd you make out?" I said, "Oh, well, okay, you know, we just sort of hung around and brushed my teeth twice a day and just waited for something to happen, you know, ready to wave my arms or start my fire." I had built a smudge pot thing to make smoke, which is how they found me. And she said, "Well, what did you eat?" And I said, "Chacachamna chicken soup." She said, "How do you make that?" I said, "Well, you take Sunny Jim peanut butter can and you put some snow in it and you use your blowtorch to make hot water, and you imagine you put a chicken in and drink it quick." And she put that on the AP wire and went nationwide. There were headlines in the papers all over the United States. Chicken soup gets them through.
Imaginary chicken soup.
Yeah. But that was, I just knew that staying alive was more important than trying to be a hero and do something really stupid. So on several occasions in my lifetime of flying, I've parked airplanes, but I've only actually hurt that one.
So you you put your ego aside and decided that the better course of action was to not try to be brave, but to be smart.
Yeah, be smart.
Yes. Pilots in Alaska have to be highly skilled to fly, especially in the rural parts of the state. Talk about some of the big changes in aviation that you've seen here in the last 50, 60 years.
Well, when I first ran for office in 64, I was lucky enough to be put on the Finance Committee. And with my aviation background and interests and being on the Finance Committee, I dug around in the federal budget and found some money that could be used to build airports. And my thought at the time was the only way you're going to possibly be able to connect these various communities in Alaska is by air. We couldn't afford to build roads. As you know, there's like 56 villages out in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. And you can't, it's not possible to connect them with roads. It would cost a fortune. And we didn't have a fortune. So we went after all of that money we could get to build small airports, and we began building them, small to medium-sized airports. So in the early days of statehood, we built big airports in Ketchikan and Wrangell and Petersburg. We built one in St. Mary's, and we started connecting with getting the airplanes on wheels rather than using big float planes and Grumman Gooses and things like that for Southeast. So we're able to get into land planes, which are cheaper to operate, and to connect these villages together. So my idea was to get as much of that money as we could. In one case, we got every dollar the federal government had in their budget for those airports. And the guy from Arizona was complaining like mad. He wrote an article that was in the Anchorage, a letter to the editor in the Anchorage paper. Stop Cesera. He's taking all the money for all the airports for the whole United States. But that's... Anyway, that's how we got this. That's one way to stand this country on its feet, was to get those airports in.
Mm-hmm. Is that part of the reason that you decided to run for state office, or what really prompted? I mean, you had a career and a life, and why did you decide to run for office?
I was living out at Big Lake at the time, and we had just become gone from territorial status to being a state, and I just looked at the thing, and I have got to get involved. You know, I just had to do it. I just was compelled to get involved. So I moved from Big Lake to Anchorage to get into a bigger district, which was in those days was 14 House members and 7 senators in the overall Anchorage Bowl area, and we ran at large. And I didn't know a soul, you know, but I filed and ran. And won an election to the House. And by the way, one of the funny things that happened was right after I got elected, a check came in the mail for $300. And I asked one of the other legislators, what's that for? He says, that's for stationery. I said, we get paid to buy our stationery? Yeah. Then another check came. It was for $200. So I called him up and said, what's this $200? He says, that's your paycheck. I said, we get paid to be legislators? Wow, is that cool? That's how much I knew about the legislature at the time. Our salary was $2,500 a year, about $200 a month. And all of us who were there were, you know, taking a huge financial hit to be in the legislature. And I love those guys. I really did. We had a wonderful bunch of people in the legislature in the early 50s and 60s, late 50s and early 60s. They were totally dedicated to what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Beyond the rural airport issue, what were some of the other big issues that you really tackled in office?
I was much in... I came out of the California school system, as I said. So I looked at the overall situation. I wanted to spend as much money as we possibly could on education, period. That was one of my driving thoughts, was education, education, education. And as I looked around, I realized that we had a lot of kids that were having a hard time getting into college because they had to go to South 48 to go to school or go to Fairbanks. The cost was about the same. So I wrote a piece suggesting that one of the things we should do is build a campus, University of Alaska campus in Anchorage, where the kids were. And when I did that, I published that paper in the Anchorage Times, And Bob Atwood, who is the editor or publisher of the Times, wrote a piece the next day blasting me for suggesting such a crazy thing, because his issue was he was the president of the Board of Regents for Alaska Methodist University, and he didn't want us stepping on him. And then Eugene Short wrote one. He didn't want us stepping on the community college. Then Dr. Wood wrote one, not to be outdone. He writes one and says, don't spend the money in Anchorage, spend it in Fairbanks. But I prevailed, and we got the University of Alaska. So I'm sort of, I'm the midwife of UAA.
Well, that is a great story. And we are talking with Chuck Cicera today. He's written a book, Chuck Cicera's Alaska, Propellers, Politics, and People. And we're going to take a short break. But when we come back, we'll take your calls and talk with Eric and Naknek.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Thanks for staying with us for Talk of Alaska today. Our guest is Chuck Cicera. We're talking about Alaska and his wide-ranging adventures. Now we're going to take a call from Eric in Naknek. Good morning, Eric.
Hey, good morning.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to give a short, brief story about what happened to me, and then I'd like to question some advice, and I'm kind of trying to figure out whether I should stay in Alaska or head off to Texas. I did really well in school as a kid. When I hit the eighth grade, I knew that no one could beat me in mathematics. I know that sounds arrogant, but I continued on that path and literally tried to beat or confuse any mathematics students because I always wanted to be ahead of the game. You know, you can go all the way to calculus in college while I was studying for petroleum engineering. And you can have some of the so-called geniuses who come up to me and look at my test at the end of the day where we go over the test when I got the 100%. And they would look at it, you know, and scan it, and they would be interested in talking with me. And you know, just the association with these so-called geniuses and also my ability to get the highest grade in class or to get these 100% tests, that calculus test, I scribbled it from the start to the finish as fast as I could, working as fast as I could in my brain, and I remember lifting my pencil and thinking, what did I write? And I remember thinking, I got a C at least. And I thought, man, I got a C, that sucks. And I came back and got 100%. And this is my mathematics mind. And so I just became an engineer because my math teacher in high school named Rob told me to go on to engineering because math teacher wouldn't make enough money for what I wanted because he knew I was into entertainment and in sports that would cost a lot of money.
And did
so
you say you're looking for some advice?
Fairbanks because they had the closest thing to chemical engineering. And I fell in love with petroleum engineering thanks to a guy named Sharish. Anyways, I got really big really fast. And there's a group up there, an engineering honor group. And they kind of took me in and were nice to me. And anyways, I got jobs pretty early. I went to Texas for my first job as a production engineer, and things were moving very fast. Nothing was wrong with my life at all. I did a karaoke event in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Okay, Eric, let's get to the point here. Eric,
Lumberjay.
Eric.
And at any rate, there was two gentlemen that
can you hear me?
Something about me, and I lost my career over it. I wanted to ask the guy on the show today what he thinks I should do, since I've been in Alaska for 7 years and I can't get an interview. So I went from being big stuff to can't get an interview because two guys from another country made up stuff about me. What should I do? Should I stay in Alaska or should I go back to Texas?
Wow.
I think you should go back to Texas.
All right. Well, thank you, Eric, for the call. And you got your advice there from Mr. Cicera. We are going to take another call now. Martha is in Anchorage. Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning. Did you have a question?
Good morning. I'm still getting over the last call. I'll second that motion, Mr. Cicera. And I was, my ears perked up when I heard the part about the Alaska in the 50s and 60s. Could you speak to Alaska, where you were saying that the legislators really had a mission to improve the then territory, which became a state? So could you speak to that that spirit that you had then, before oil was discovered, and what I call what developed since then, this poverty of spirit, where we have billions of dollars, but we have a legislature that can't get business done in the allotted amount of time, and even when they're getting paid more than you ever got paid. So could you speak to that, sir?
I sure would be
happy. Thank you, Martha.
Be happy to. You know, when I got elected, I didn't know a soul in Anchorage, really. And I got into the legislature and started meeting my fellow legislators. I was absolutely amazed at what a wonderful bunch of guys they were and ladies. And the whole group was dedicated to trying to make a state out of a territory. And I was in complete awe of some of them. John Butrovich, for instance, up in Fairbanks, it's just a wonderful statesman-like type fellow. We had people that came from left jobs that were paying a lot of money to take this job, which paid nothing, because they wanted to make a state. And we were all, I likened the early legislators to a bunch of sailors in a boat. We had 60 sailors in a boat rowing. Some had long oars and some had short oars, but we were all rowing in the same direction. And so I love the group I was with. We're still friends all these years, and we got our satisfaction by creating a state out of a rough-hewn territory.
1-800-478-8255 is the number if you'd like to join our conversation today with Chuck Cicera. 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422, and you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. While you were in the legislature, you worked with Ted Stevens. What was your working relationship like with him? You were a Democrat. How did the two of you get along?
I'll tell you how we got along. We were close as two human beings can be without being married. That's how close we were. Ted and I, we both were UCLA Bruins. That was one of the first things. We were both married to girls named Ann. We both had kids. I had two and he had five. And one time when Ann and I were during a session, we'd rented our house out. And when we came back from Juneau, our house was still occupied. We couldn't get in it. So I went over to Ted's office and threw a rock against the glass. And he opened the window and looked out. What do you want? I said, give me the keys to your house. I'm moving in. He said, okay. So he threw the keys out. So I went over to his house, opened the door, and Ann and I and our dog moved in, right? And our two kids and our dog moved in. And about a few hours later, Ted comes home and sees this crowd in there. And we were laughing about the fact that we were crowded in this little log cabin he had at the time, a little two-story rig. And who drives in the driveway? Ann Stevens with five kids and another dog. So we all lived together in one bathroom. It was hilarious. You had to take numbers to stand up. But anyway, so we worked closely together in the legislature. And many, many, many times, which I can't really tell all the stories about it right now, when Ted needed some advice or he needed someone to just lean on, he would call on me. And I was happy to serve in that capacity with him. So we were really close, as close as that, like brothers. I tell you, when he died, I was broken down crying over that, because I did have a long history with him and admired him. I argued with him a little bit about his policy of going on into Washington, D.C. and ripping off all the money he could for the state. But you had to admire him for doing it. But I said, do you know where that money comes from, Ted? Some poor little rascal that works in a steam fitting operation in Ohio pays it into his paycheck, and you're taking that money and spending it in Alaska. But he just laughed and kept on doing it.
You had a long conversation with him before he decided to jump into the race to get into the Senate. Tell us about that car trip.
Oh, well, Ted had in mind he wanted to be a U.S. Senator. He ran once and lost. And he lost in a primary to Elmer Rasmussen, which we all laughed. We said, Ted, how can you lose to a banker, you know? Anyway, he was still hanging around the fringes trying to get another shot. And he's looking at the two U.S. senators who were both Democrats at the time, Bob Bartlett and Ernest Greening. And Ernest was in his late 80s. And so everybody's looking at Ernest figuring he's going to just keel over, you know, one of these days. And so they're busy looking at him, and no, it's Bob Bartlett that dies. Well, now there's an opening in the legislature, and Wally Hickel was the governor. And so Wally gets to appoint the new senator. So everybody assumed that Wally would appoint his best friend, who is I'm having a senior moment, Brady. Brady. Anyway, Carl Brady. And so, but Carl had just lost an election for a state office, and his star was a little tarnished. And I don't know why. There was a word out that he didn't really want the job very badly, but Ted wanted it very badly, and he was practically hanging around, sleeping on the yard, waiting in front of Wally Hickel's house, waiting for him to appoint him. Well, finally it did happen. He got appointed. But I think I remember the story you wanted me to tell, and I'm sorry I missed that. Ted and I spent one time. Ted called me and said, I need to talk to you. I said, okay. So he came by the place and picked me up. We got in his car, and we drove around for about 4 or 5 hours around Anchorage and just drove aimlessly while he explained to me that he was broke. Which wasn't anything new for any of us, really, because we didn't make any money being legislators, that's for sure. So he was broke, and he had all these kids, and he had been offered a job to go to Washington, D.C. to be a lobbyist for a Chrysler Corporation, and he would have paid about $50,000 a year, which was big money in those days, and would have solved all his problems. But he says, I really want to be a United States Senator. If I do that, I can't ever do it. But on the other hand, if I don't take this job, I'm going to have to file bankruptcy in the next few weeks. I mean, it's that bad. So what will I do? Well, I said, boy, you really come up with the doozies. So we drove around another hour or two, and finally I said to him, look, Ted, miracles do happen. I believe in them. I said, what you need to do is nothing. Just get calm, calm down, wait. Something will happen good in your life. Well, it wasn't so good for Ernest Greening, but it was good for Ted when the opening appeared, and he now could go after that seat and got it with not the blessings. I mean, I don't think Wally didn't want to do it, but he did appoint him. Mm-hmm. And, of course, then he got elected on his own the next time and the next time and the next time.
Yeah. What an amazing story, though, from almost filing bankruptcy to the U.S. Senate. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. That's 1-800-478-8255 if you'd like to join our conversation or have some questions for Chuck Cicera today. 550-8422 is the Anchorage area phone number. And you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. You have a number of connections to rural Alaska, particularly in the Bethel region, I think. Christensen Airlines, tell us about your work there, and how long did you live in that region?
Well, I flew out of there. I didn't really live there.
Than
I'd stay there when I was on duty, you might say. But I actually started flying out there in the 50s. And then I bought Ray Christensen was a legislator. Really, really terrific guy and a really great pilot. And he was half Norwegian and half Eskimo. And he was a wonderful legislator. So George Holman and I bought Ray Christensen out, Christensen Air Service. And I put a bunch of airplanes into, well, not a bunch. I put about four airplanes into the system. And we were out there operating. And when George would go to Juneau, because he was a legislator as well, I would be there running the operation, staying there all the time. But I loved flying out there. I loved meeting the people. I loved that kind of flying, and it was essential flying. You know, you brought in food. You brought in the brand-new baby into the village. You brought sick people out. You know, you felt like you were accomplishing something. And I was offered corporate jobs and airline jobs, and I couldn't see myself running around with a white shirt with four stripes on my shoulder. That didn't suit my character, I guess, or my desires. But I felt like I was actually accomplishing something when I went and landed in a village and brought in the people. It's what they needed to live. And I laugh because one of the pictures in my book is a picture of a Pilatus Porter, which is a great big airplane built in Switzerland, a single-engine airplane, about the size of a de Havilland Beaver, maybe a bit bigger, actually. And people in these villages would laugh because this thing was sort of ungainly looking with big, long, spindly legs and a big, long snout of a nose on it. And I'd fly over, and they'd all come out and line up on the little dirt strip and sit there and watch while I landed this thing in a big crosswind. And I told them, I said, you guys keep this up. I'm going to fly over one of these days, and this thing's got a bomb bay in it, and I'll have all your grosses in the bomb bay, and I'll fly over you, and I'll just pull the handle and drop your tin cans and your Coca-Cola and your peanut butter, jars of peanut butter, right on the middle of the runway with my... drop it out through the bomb bay, you know.
Give them something to really watch.
Something to write home about, yeah.
So in your book, you also write about nuns that were out in that area who wanted to be U.S. citizens. You helped that effort. Tell us about that.
Well, that's one of the best stories in my book, and I just loved it. And when I would get beat up by some yahoo that would say, what'd you ever do when you were in the legislature, you know, I just rather than discuss building schools and things like that, I would tell them this story. I was flying in St. Mary's, and there was a mission school there, and I would be flying up and down the Yukon River, delivering the mail and bringing stuff in. And so I got to know Mother Superior, and she was a very handsome lady, probably about 50 years old, and we became very good friends. And so I one time I landed there, and she said to me, I was stuck there over, this is where I was. I was stuck there overnight because the weather turned bad. So I was in the curled up in the cockpit of a 185 and on skis and I crawled in. I'm not a little guy. I'm crawling in this plane trying to get a little bit of sleep. When the knocking starts on this outside airplane, I open the door and there's a little Eskimo boy and he says, Come with me. Well, Mother Superior wants to see you. I go, okay. So I get out of the plane. I go up to the place where the nuns lived, and I said, what's up? She says, Chuck, you can't sleep in an airplane like that. You come stay here. So I said, okay. So I did. And then in the morning, we go down to the dining room at the school, and she comes over laughing to me, and she says, did the goblins get you last night? And I said, no. I was really worried about it, but I figured that lightning wouldn't hit me that close to a bunch of nuns. But anyway, she said to me, do you speak any Italian? I know you have an Italian last name. I said, oh, handful of words. She says, well, I have an Italian nun here who's been here for years and years. Could you come over and say hello to her? And I said, certainly. So I went up behind this nun. She was in the cooking. She had a spatula in one hand and a rag in the other, and she's yelling orders and stuff. I grab her around the around the neck and shoulders, and I say to her, Buongiorno, che so questa, which is actually Spanish. I know how to do it in Italian, but right now I can't think of it. And she spun around and started crying. So I'm holding on to her, and she's just really broke up. And I turned to Mother Superior and said, what's going on? She said, whoa, she hasn't heard her mother tongue in 60 years. So we started talking back and forth between us in broken Italian, broken English, and broken Eskimo. It was hilarious. But anyway, at that end of this period of time, I said, I have to leave. I'm going back to Anchorage this afternoon, but I'll be back in about a week. And I asked the nun, Sister Tekla, I said, Sister, can I bring you anything? And for the life of me, I couldn't think of what an 80-year-old nun would need, but I asked. And she said, yes, there is one thing I'd like. You name it. She says, I'd like to be a U.S. citizen. Why, I couldn't believe my ears. I turned to Mother Superior and said, what's happened here? She says, well, she left Italy when she was like a teenage girl, came to Bethel because she had a calling. She's been here 60 years. She's applied for citizenship 4, 5, 6 times, but it was always too difficult to put it together. So she couldn't leave here and go down the river and go back by ship to Seattle to do it or anything like that. And later when they started flying airplanes, she just wouldn't get in an airplane. So I said, don't worry, I will do this. So I came back into Anchorage, and the first thing I did was I called Mike Gravello, who was a U.S. senator in Washington, and he had been in the legislature with me. And I called him. I said, Mike, I need something. He said, no airline routes. I can't help you with that right now. I said, no, this is much tougher than that. I'm going to send you some signed papers, applications for citizenship. I'm sending them by express mail today, and I want you to take them to the INS and stand there while they sign them. There's nothing to discuss. In the meantime, I picked up the second nun who had only been there 46 years, Sister Scholastica. So I had these papers that I'd made up, and I signed them all with my name. I said, Sister Scholastica by Charles Cicera, Sister Tekla by Charles Cicera. The INS looked at it, grabbed it and signed it and handed it back to Mike, and he sent it back to me. We got turned around in one day. Whole INS process.
Not then, the same as today.
Yeah. Then I needed to have a judge go out there. So I called up Ray Plummer, whose son still practices law here in town. And Ray and I were good friends. And I called Ray, he was a federal judge. And I called him up and said, Ray, could you move your court out to St. Mary's so we can get this woman and her, these women, their citizenship? He says, I'm going to call you right back. I'm going to talk to my clerk. If he wants to go, he'll go with me, I'll do it. So he called me back an hour later and says, my clerk says, yeah, let's go. He said, we'll do it. You just call and tell me when you want us out there. So then I called up Ray Peterson, president of Ween Airlines, and I said, hey, or Consolidated. I said, Ray, I need a favor. He says, what do you know? No money. I don't have any money. I said, no, I don't need any money. What I want to do is have your airplane, F-27 turboprop, when it lands in St. Mary's, to stay there for about 2 or 3 hours on the ground. What for, he says. I said, well, we have two nuns. You may know them, because Ray is no bush pilot. They're Tekla and Scholastica. We're trying to get them their U.S. citizenship, but I need a plane to stay there long enough to get the ceremony taken care of. So he said, I'll call you right back. Yep, he says, the crew says they'd love to do that because they didn't get paid for sitting on the ground like that. So on the appropriate Thursday, whatever it was, we got on the plane, the clerk, the judge, and myself, and the crew, of course, and other passengers. And we flew around, and we landed at St. Mary's. When we rolled to a stop on the gravel runway there, there were about 50 Eskimos standing out with furs on, standing out on the edge of the runway. We taxied up to them, shut the engines down, and climbed out. And it was an old 6x6 GI truck, big 10-wheeler. Pull up there, it was the only vehicle in the village. And they insisted that we get up in it and drive two blocks into Bethel.
St. Mary's.
Where am I at? Into St. Mary's. And with an escort, with the Eskimos walking beside us. So we went on in. When we got to the school, the gymnasium, we stopped and climbed down, and another, opened the door and look in there, another surprise. The place is packed with people. There must have been 300 people or more in the gymnasium sitting on the floor, all in their furs.
Mm.
Eskimos had to walk miles and miles and miles to be there. Then the judge came out. They set up in the center of the court. They set up a table with flags and stuff on it. And the judge came out with his black robe, and the clerk says, hear ye, federal court, district so-and-so is now in session. And the two little nuns stood up there with their little things about 4 foot 6 inches tall with arthritic-looking hands, and they raised their right hand and they swore to defend the United States against all aggression, foreign or domestic. In other words, they were willing to pick up a rifle and defend the United States. And the judge says, you're now U.S. citizens. And the crowd burst into song. They sang America the Beautiful. There wasn't a dry eye in the place, including me, the pilot, the co-pilot, the flight attendant, the judge, the clerk. All of us were weeping. And guess what the date was? Christmas Eve, December 24th, 1969.
Wow.
That's my story, and I'm sticking with it.
Well, on that note, we are going to take one more quick little break here. And when we come back, we'll have more stories with Chuck Cicera as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
We are talking with Chuck Cicera today, former state lawmaker, aviator, sailor, all businessman. He's done a lot in Alaska and throughout his life. We have an email question here, Mr. Cicera, so I'm going to ask that right now. This person writes, please enlighten us listeners on your view of Alaska's future. Give your perspective on what you think Alaska is heading for.
Well, I'm not a soothsayer, you know. I'm pretty pleased with what we're doing, the way the state has developed since I've been here. But I think we could have done more. I would have liked to have had more money spent on the University of Alaska. I think we could be the premier university in the world on things like climate change, fisheries, forestry, I think we had an opportunity to be the premier university in the world on those kind of issues. Mm. And I'm disappointed in that part of it. I think I was at a party the other night where there were people dancing. It was a birthday party for a good friend of mine. And I looked at the crowd. It was a wonderful mix of people. There were Samoans there doing hula dancing. There were people doing clogging, you know, Irish clogging. And I looked around at the crowd, the faces, and it's a wonderful mix of people. I think we have a fantastic community. When you look at the overall picture in Alaska, we have a mix of people that are making a new world, really, here.
Mm-hmm. We certainly do. It is an amazing place and amazing diverse population, and that's one of the beautiful things about Alaska for sure. We only have a couple minutes left, but tell us about when you were in the legislature and working with Governor Egan, Bill Egan. He made you bologna sandwiches on a plane once from Juneau to Anchorage. Tell us about that.
Well, I was on, as I said before, I was on the Finance Committee. I was working. It was Friday night, and it was pretty late. And I'm still sitting at my desk working, and everybody else had gone home or gone to wherever they went, watering holes, I suppose. But anyway, I got a call. So the clerk came to me and said, yeah, I wanted on the phone. So I went to the phone. I said, hello. And he says, hey, what are you doing there? And I said, who is this? He said, Bill Egan. I said, hi, Governor, what's up? He says, I understand your mother's in the hospital in Anchorage, going to be operated on. What are you doing here? I said, well, I got work to do, and, you know, it costs money and time to go up there. He says, look, I've got a plane going up there. I'm going up in about 2 or 3 hours. You come on, I'll pick you up, and we'll fly up together. I said, oh, cool. So he comes by with his black Lincoln, or Chrysler car with the official plates on it, picks me up. We drive out to Juneau Airport. On the way, he stops at a grocery store and buys a bag of stuff. We go out, and we get on, drive out onto the apron next to the airplane. It was an Air Guard C-123 boxcar, his flying boxcar, with a big door that opened on the back so you could put a vehicle in it. We go around, and I walk around the back and look in, and there, what's inside there is a 15-foot camp trailer tied down to the floor. So we walk in and open the door, and there was a little dinette, and we sat down at the dinette and closed the door, and they raised the lid. They closed the back door of the airplane, fired up, and took off. As soon as we got up to level flight, Governor gets up and gets his paper bag out, lays out bologna and onions and mayonnaise and whatever, and he starts building sandwiches. And I said, wow, this is a governor. This is a governor to love, right? And we're riding along, and he's full of beans, you know, he's telling me stories and stuff. He says to me, you know, I used to own an airplane. I said, no lie, what was it? He says it was an Ronca C-3. I said, my God, Governor, that thing looks like was designed by Walt Disney. I said, it was a two-cylinder engine and only 36 horsepower. I said, That's a really look like Mickey Mouse would have been driving it. He said, yeah, but he said it was supposed to be a good flyer. He says, I picked it up in Anchorage, and I was going to fly it back to Valdez. He said, and I had Jack Carr build a fuel tank for us, so I had extra fuel. It was a 2.5-gallon tank that he mounted on the floor right between my legs, and then they put a hand pump on it to pump fuel. And I took off in that plane and flew at the Valdez in a snowstorm. When I was pumping fuel like crazy, it was leaking all over my legs. I thought I was going to blow up. I didn't know where I was. I was lost and running around in the snow. And all of a sudden, I see Valdez's arm, and I go over to the airport. And they told me the airport was open and there was, you know, no snow. But while I was in the air, 4 feet of snow had fallen, I put the airplane down, and that was the end of my flying career.
Well, I'm glad that you're still here today after all those adventures, and your book will be in stores early in August. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. Chuck Cicera's Alaska, Propellers, Politics, and People. You can pick up a copy in August. Thanks to Dave Waldron and Evan Erickson.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Baby salmon live here, right in our backyards and neighborhoods. Go out, explore, and take the Baby Salmon Challenge. For more information, go to babysalmon.fish. This announcement is sponsored by the Salmon Project. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.